Welcome back to Rhetoric Warriors, the podcast dedicated to exploring the power of ethical-only persuasion. We are canceling unethical persuasion here at Rhetoric Warriors. Follow us on social media. I tweet jokes all day long at Rhetoric War. I couldn't get Rhetoric Warriors. It's too long for Twitter. So it's now Rhetoric at Rhetoric War. Here are a couple of jokes from the week. I realized this week that my favorite thing about Winston Churchill was that he made the entire government work around his naps. He literally programmed his naps into his days and like he wouldn't take meetings, which I think is awesome. I think it's odd that it's 2021 and people now scream out fragments of the Constitution as arguments. Like they just yell a number of an amendment and that is now somehow an argument. If you actually go in and read the amendments, you're like, yeah, I'm not real sure that supports your point. And a final joke. I became worried this week that maybe tofu is short for toe fungus. It fits. Tofu, toe fungus. I am Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, escaped professor, also stand-up comedian and comedy writer from late night in Hollywood. This podcast is designed to talk to comedians about their politics. It's also designed to find persuasion professionals, which is what we're doing this week. And I also convert the right, which is my hobby these days. You can visit us at rhetoricwarriors.com and take our master course in modern persuasion, which is 25 weeks for $25, a dollar a week for a major education. How about that? Or our new course, Convert One Conservative, which is getting ready to launch, where I will teach liberals how to go grab conservatives and bring them back to whatever you want to bring them back to. Soon I'll add in the convert one liberal so I can be balanced. Not really care about being balanced, but I will anyway. But I can only write so fast. So there you go. Let me introduce my guest for the week. This week we are talking to the wonderful Farnaz Wallace, who is a former CMO of a major corporation. Right? When you say major corporation?
Yeah. Well, somewhat major. Yeah.
That's pretty big. It's Fortune 500 at least, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Pretty up there.
We used to be at least.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that, about being a female in a major corporation here in America and doing that work. She's also a thought leader on rapid cultural and demographic shifts in the modern world. She does really cool presentations and talks about that around the country. She used to do that as a little business, but I think she's like, I'm not going to work that hard.
That's true.
And she immigrated to the U.S. from Iran to Louisiana, which how many people have done that? Not a lot. So she's got a lot of perspectives on that. You can check her out at farnazglobal.com or find her on LinkedIn. Welcome the fascinating Farnaz.
Hello, Dan. Hello, everyone.
Hello, Farnaz. How are you?
What's up? I'm good. In this crazy world, better than expected.
Yeah, this is like 1 week and a day after the insurrection of America. You know, we've got 5 days left until Biden takes his oath of office, which here's what I want to happen. I want him to take the oath of office. He has his hand on his Bible and the other hand up. He says, yes, I do, or whatever. And then he takes his hand off and he's like, are we done? Are we good? Is it final? Great. I resign. That's your new president. I'm tired. I'll see y'all later. Go get him.
Well, he already said he's just going to run one term. So,
yeah, I mean, good gosh, the guy's 78.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of work at 78. Huh?
I think he's 76, but I'm not sure.
I don't know, man. That's but I would love for him to usher in, you know, sort of a new Democratic crowd and then be like, hey, I did my job. Let's move on.
Yeah.
So tell us your background a little bit. I ran it just a little bit there, but introduce yourself to us, Farnaz.
I am actually Farnaz Safavi Wallace. Safavi was my maiden name. And in Iran, you don't have middle names. So it's first name, last name. So I kept my last name as my middle name. So it's actually Farnaz Safavi Wallace. And I might.
How do you spell that?
Actually, it spells like Safari, but with a V instead. So it's Safavi, but as you can imagine, most Americans pronounce it Safavi, just like safari.
Oh yeah, Safavi.
So it's really Safavi, and there's no other way to spell it.
Yeah, well, I'm from Kentucky originally, so it's really hard for me to get to any
I will not hold
sophisticated
that against you.
Pronunciations of anything.
Well, pronunciation is an interesting thing when you migrate from another country. Because when you think about the pronunciation of fat, like a fat person, the A after the F is A, but then when you say F-A-R, it immediately becomes far. So it changes. So it's really hard. So I don't really hold their feet to the fire to pronounce my name exactly, because it's really hard to spell it the way you're supposed to say it.
Yeah, you would end up doing a lot of teaching if you cared about the minutiae of how well they pronounce that in America.
I don't. I had an accent for decades. I still do. And I probably pronounce people's names with an accent all the entire time I was here. So I didn't mind them having an accent. I did mind when they said, oh, we need to choose a nickname, American nickname for you. And I was like, no, you don't.
Yeah, Wallace is an American last name. That's your married name, right? So
was. I kind of kept it as a business name for SEO sake. So I kind of kept Farno Safavi Wallace.
So tell us about that. Just sort of run your background a little bit on you were in Iran until 15 and then you immigrated here. So just give us a little bit of that story. That's got to be
I think pretty much everyone in Iran and my family in Iran were very politically, maybe not so active as aware. And everyone knew that sooner or later the regime would change. There was a lot of unrest in the country.
What year was that? Was that 70s?
Mid to late 70s. I actually left Iran December of 77. I was 15 at the time. And I migrated to Louisiana. And the funniest thing I can share with you, and I'm not a really funny person, but you know, when moving to the US, I used to think American women look like Charlie's Angels. Or what you are exposed to in Hollywood, and the movies that were brought to Middle Eastern countries were the big ones. Do you remember $6 Million Man?
Sure, yeah.
Charlie's Angels. I mean, there were some Western. So, you know, they didn't show how American women look like in those movies. And unbeknownst to me, when I moved to Louisiana, I blended right in with the Cajun girls.
Yeah, well, dark hair, dark skin.
Peculiar name, peculiar accent, yeah. And, you know, the Cajun culture was like a country within a country. It was definitely sure. Not Hollywood, for sure. And what I was exposed to just watching American movies or listening to American people. So it was a big cultural shock for me.
Yeah, I love Louisiana culture. I've always loved that state. It's managed to be different, you know, than America. And so it's one of those places when you go on vacation there to like New Orleans, you know, you're in a different place. It feels substantially different. You know, so I've always loved that.
And the Black population in Louisiana, it look very different. They all look like me, the Creoles, the mulattoes. There are so many different cultures among the Black population there that I just really blended right in. And until I started talking, and then they knew that accent is not a Cajun accent.
That's a little too much even for us here in Creole land.
Yeah. But I enjoyed it.
Which is its own thing. Like, you can't really understand Creole. Like, it's such a distinct dialect that's not shared hardly anywhere.
No, the entire Cajun culture, you know, even when they speak English, there is a very unique accent. There are certain terminologies like chat. They say chat as in like deer, honey, that you never hear anywhere else.
That's interesting. So you were in Iran during the regime change from the Shah over to...
Actually, a couple of years before.
Okay. We'll talk about that, because this podcast is, you know, set up to talk about persuasion and politics and how, you know, all these things sort of charge up together. And when somebody comes from another culture, especially like you, who, you know, at 15, you're fairly aware of what's around you. And you said you're from a fairly intellectual family too, and political. So you were aware of a lot of things. And then you moved here and, you know, you have American politics and the way we do things. So, you know, talk about some of that transition, like for you, like, you know, you were in that culture. transitioned over here, and describe that a little bit.
A lot of what I knew before I moved here was not that far from what I have experienced this last 40 years, 40 plus years. We were well aware of the racism issues in the US back in the 70s in Iran. I mean, Muhammad Ali was beloved in the Middle Eastern countries and Muslim countries, obviously, because of his religion. And he addressed a lot of those issues. So the exposure was there. Everybody knew the suppression of Black and brown people. The biggest culture shock for me moving here was going from a very large metropolitan city of Tehran, which was like a Paris of Middle East. It was called that actually back then, to a small town in Louisiana.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I know. It anyone outside of Baton Rouge was a foreigner. So you can just imagine the Iranian students in that little Catholic high school, Our Lady of Fatima in Lafayette. You can just imagine how shocked they were. And they would ask questions like, did you live in houses?
Right.
You know, did you have highways? I mean, those kids just didn't know. They weren't exposed to anything outside of Louisiana, let alone in the country.
And that's, you know, America's has such a long, you know, twisty history with Iran, you know, and the Middle East.
Yep.
And it became, you know, after, you know, there was a time in the 80s when suddenly, you know, with Khomeini and, you know, Jimmy Carter and the hostages and all that kind of stuff, suddenly people are like, what's this place? You know, and they learned a really strong version of Iran, but they didn't learn the complexity and the multiplicity of Iran. They learned one thing and one storyline. And, you know, that's a fairly intense storyline that Americans have carried about that country ever since.
Dan, spoiler alert, it's still the same. 2021, it's still the same.
Yeah, super strong.
Really, yeah, I mean, they really think Iran is what you see in the news, the mullahs and the ayatollahs. You know, it would be very similar if someone from another country thought, and some do, that U.S. is what you see in Trump rallies. And we both know that's not the case.
Yeah, but that, again, that has become a very strong narrative carried out by the media right now. And it's going to dominate, you know, for a lot of, especially young people in other countries growing up and who hadn't seen the long tradition of other, you know, the way America has been depicted. You know, this is the way now America is being depicted. And that's what they're going to expect, you know, this constant upheaval, you know, which is what they did with Iran, right? I mean, it was upheaval. They showed all the massive protests. They showed Khomeini's body. They showed all that kind of stuff. And that's what everybody, you know, came to know.
True, true. And to your point, Iran wasn't even under anyone's radar until the revolution happened back in 1978. But at least with American media, you do see, you know, I mean, American Hollywood is global. So you're exposed to more than just Trump rallies. Whereas when it comes to a country like Iran in Middle East, no one's exposed to how actually people live, what they think, what they believe, how multicultural Iran itself is, and what the younger generation, the more educated generation, what they're like. You're not exposed to that at all. In fact, I would venture to say that that's not unique to Iran. It's also the same with all Muslim countries. And I'm not a religious person, as you can imagine, but I'm always pretty amazed of the low representation of Muslims and Islamic countries in media, in politics. I mean, they're just not represented. So what people are exposed to and what they understand is nothing like what you experience when you go back there. Iran is often viewed the same as Saudi Arabia, and that is like night and day different.
Really? How would you compare it, like two states here? What would be the difference? Like what kind of state would Iran be versus like a state that Saudi Arabia would be? Would be like Georgia, New York, or?
But, okay, this hopefully will be a little funny for your audience. Having worked for Church's Chicken for 16 years, I was exposed to cities and towns and trade areas, so to speak, where the restaurants were located. that were very third world. So I think within every state, you're going to have that. Within every city, you're going to have that. So in Austin or Dallas, for example, if you go from certain parts of the inner city to the suburb, you feel like you're in another country. Right. The difference is with on the business side, with the growth of franchise, whether it's restaurants or Home Depots of the world or Bed Bath and Beyond, you're not going to see that big of a difference from one city to another. But within the city itself, the urban versus rural versus suburban cultures are so different. So I would probably say, in comparison, I wouldn't go city versus city. I would go areas versus areas, because within one city, you're going to have completely different culture. You're going to have some third world areas. You're going to have rich areas. It reminds me a lot of when I traveled to India for business. You know, you could be in this amazing Taj Mahal hotel and walk out and you see a completely different world and people washing themselves in the street and, you know, certain types of animals, whether it's elephants or cows walking. And it's just stepping outside of the hotel, you see such a big difference. I wouldn't go it's that intensely in US, but again, having had that experience of touring different parts of the US, where I used to call it sweat and soul of America, you know, in the rural country and in the really low income urban areas where actually churches, restaurants were located in, it's a different world that Americans are exposed to. I think most people think America are these large cities, especially the intellectual liberals, you know, especially what I used to say to the C-suite and the executives, and the closest they got to the customers was probably talking to a maid in a restaurant. I mean, in a hotel or someone who's cleaning the golf courses. They're so out of touch with what America really is. These large cities we all live in are not a good representation of America. And that's why people got caught off guard when Trump got elected.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I think, you know, so for people listening in, Farnaz was the CMO for Church's Chicken, which is, you know, how many franchises they have? Like,
they had, at least back then, they had roughly about 1,200. They may be up to 1,400. It's kind of like a Kentucky Fried Chicken for urban areas.
Right. So it works mostly towards black markets. It's mostly in urban areas. It's very, very well known. Like, there's a few franchises that do that, like Popeyes, I think is similar, you know, and Churches. And, you know, we've talked about this at different times, like coming from what you're talking about with that sort of high powered executive C-suite view of the world, which is the kind of urban, you know, city and educated and everybody's, you know, dressed in suits and all that stuff. But your business is selling to people that aren't that at all. And I think that's one of the things that you bridge really well, because, and maybe it is because you come from multiple cultures, that you're able to move back and forth between those cultures. And you understand that, you know, there's a plurality of cultures and you have to learn those if you're going to be effective with those cultures.
Absolutely. And I think most sophisticated marketers are that way. They are smart enough to separate themselves from the customer and understand that in order to understand the customer, you have to spend days and days in the life of the customer and do some cultural immersion, so to speak. But not everyone does that.
Yeah, and that's not the glamorous part, right? That's that kind of deep research. And so the course that I'm getting ready to launch about Convert One Conservative, I have a very structured process for converting people politically. And it goes from discovery as the first stage to relationship building. So that, you know, you actually have a foundation for talking and then you can start doing persuasion. Everybody wants to just jump into persuasion, but if you don't do what you're talking about, which is real discovery, like deep phenomenological, emotional, everyday life discovery, then you really don't know what messages to send to those people. And so you shouldn't even try to persuade those people. You know, you've got to do that discovery.
I completely agree. I like the terminologies you're using, because we often used, you know, a lot of the cliche words in marketing. But to your point, what I was describing in terms of the business aspect and spending days in the life of the customer and immersed in their culture is also holds true for any type of persuasion, because marketing is a type of persuasion. And if a liberal wants to convert the conservative, they first must understand the conservative. Yeah.
And they don't. It's really hard.
They don't. It's like, have you spent days and nights and years in the life of a conservative or a life of a Trump supporter to understand what they are saying? Because that whole concept of listening, and I think you had that in one of your newsletters too, you know, people don't really know how to listen. They don't know how to hold space for an opposing point of view.
Yeah, and it's hard. People, like, I had this discussion with my daughter once when she was, I don't know, 14 or so. And she would come to me with an issue and, you know, that she was going through. And I'd be like, oh my God, this is so hard to listen to you. And I told her at some point, I think teenage girl emotions are somehow toxic to dads or to middle-aged men, at least. And I'm like, we've got to figure this out because I really care and I'm going to help. But I end up just absorbing it. You know, it's too intense for me. I don't know how to be that kind of sieve listener that, like, therapist or mom's a therapist. And they learn to listen to intense, horrible things, but not hold on to them. And most people aren't trained to do that. So I'm like, I've got like 7 minutes where I can listen and hear you cry. And after that, you know, we have to take a break or I have to do it non-verbally because it's just too much for me. And I think a lot of people, when they try to do political talk, that's what happens. So they hear all this vehement political beliefs and they just react to it and they can't absorb it and end up arguing instead of listening, you know, and discovering.
Could the flip side also be true that because you absorb it so well, there's so much of it you can take, and perhaps not every person trying to persuade would do that. The listening part is so different from what I'm hearing from you and just knowing you. You listen really well. And at some point it gets too much. But what I have perceived with opposing views with politics or business or any type of disagreement, people don't listen. They don't really absorb.
Yeah.
And that should be the first step. It's okay to absorb and say, okay, I've had enough absorption. Let me take a quick break. But it's another to not do it at all and pretend that you know, because you don't.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in good relationships and good, you know, families, you do, like, and I recognize that she needed something, you know, and she's important to me. So I wanted to give it to her. I just know what I was like, here are my limits. And you know, maybe I can go and, like, I start doing a little research on listening as a therapist. Like, how do you do that? And that's something you can learn, you know, where you don't, like, one of the things that you'll do is, like, if you hear somebody crying, if you haven't heard people cry very much, it's a novel emotion. It's too much. Men don't do that much of it. And so it overwhelms them, but you can go and get experience with it. And, like, you get better and better at it. You know, you understand that there are lots of different reasons and ways that people cry. It's just men don't get that training, you know? So it is something you can learn, but it's got to be important to you to learn it, which is why, like, in the Convert One Conservative course, I started that because I see so many people struggling with broken families that are broken politically and they don't know how to reach out to each other. They don't know how to talk. And so they end up just not talking. You know, which is just a way to avoid the intensity and the pain of that conflict, mm-hmm. as opposed to figuring out how to deal with it. And in some ways, turn it into a positive. Like, I love talking to conservative people about what they believe. You know, they're going to have a hard time converting me because typically they're using unethical persuasion to convert. But conservative values and conservative principles are in every culture.
Of course.
You know this, you were talking about before we started, the idea of stability and slow change or no change and, you know, valorizing what we've already built instead of trying to change everything. Those things are very strong in every culture and they've become demonized because the far right has swooped into the middle moderate right and has taken over kind of their space. And that's what everybody sees now when they think about conservatives. But it wasn't always that way.
That's interesting. Yeah, I have many conservative friends, and there are those that I basically say, you're not going to change my mind about Trump, and I'm not going to change yours. So let's agree to that. And then we talk about other stuff. Because to your point, you know, there is a point of commonality. We need to figure out what that is first. If we don't build on commonality and you start off disagreeing from the beginning, it's just, you have 7 minutes, I have three. I mean, it just exhausts me. It completely depletes me. My niece's husband, and I will not share this podcast with him, he's that way. He kind of builds on the opposition and he enjoys that process of disagreeing. It's kind of like a debate. You build on that, and some people thrive in that environment, some people don't. I happen to not thrive in the environment of constant disagreement. Some people do. Some people just like that. They learn from it. They like the debate part of it. And for me, I've come from a personal background of building on commonalities on the difference. Starts with differences, and we're constantly arguing without understanding that commonality. It just, it's hard. The persuasion becomes very hard because each person's going to defend and not listen.
Yeah. And I, you know, the interpersonal skills that allow you to create a relationship is that kind of middle stage. Like you learn some things, but really it's about building trust, getting them to trust that it's okay for them to say what they believe. They're not going to be attacked. They're not going to be challenged. Because, you know, nobody wants to just talk into challenge all the time. It's no fun, you know, finding ways to enjoy the conversation, which, you know, because I have a background in rhetoric, it gives me a space to say, hey, I don't care what your politics are. It really doesn't matter to me. I care about how you talk about your politics. And so let's just look at that. And that's a safer space, you know.
I like that. I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, you should. That's the whole point.
I like that. Yeah, because again, I have, even among Iranians, and this will be kind of interesting for your audience. When the revolution happened back in 78, Jimmy Carter was the president of the US. So as a result, a lot of the pro-Shah people were against Democrats. It wasn't so much that they were for Republicans that they were against. To this day, they support Trump because Trump nasty about the government, and they feel that they can relate to that. Or typically Republicans in general, for example, Bush used to say the axis of evil. Well, they thrived on that. So that created a rift, just like with the American Iranian population, created a rift of, you know, the people that were pro-Shah versus people that who were not. They take a stand with Republicans because of that. Now they don't know the first thing about the Republican policies or their platforms or none of that. It all has to do with their background of what they believe Democrats did to change the. And I, for one, don't give presidents that much power. There were so many different factors that went into that change that Jimmy Carter was just one small factor of it.
Right.
But try to persuade those people of that.
Yeah. When you get into sort of those big issues, big decisions that people have made about causes, you know, and reality, it takes more persuasion, you know, to be able to do that, which means you have to have a relationship, you have to have access. Easily takes repetitive conversations, you know, all these things that you don't really ever get access to with, you know, with people when you want to do conversion. So again, people just sort of abandon it. There are techniques to do it more slowly, you know, where you kind of leave, like one of them is to what I call thorn people. Like you give them one thing that goes against what they believe. And it's just a one little thing, but it just lives on in their mind and irritates them whenever they try to think about it. Like I have a friend who's a wonderful person, one of the most compassionate, kind people I've ever known in my life, just naturally kind of beneficent, you know, just has a niceness about him. And I hadn't seen him for years and got together a couple years ago. And about 30 minutes into the conversation, I was at his house with him and his wife. He's like, hey, Dan, what are your politics? And I'm like, Why would you ask me that? And I turned to his wife and I said, has he been watching Fox News? And she's like, yeah, every night. That's what he does. And he's like, why? Is that a problem? I'm like, yeah, Fox News is basically a hypnotic device. You know, it's a propaganda machine that's been placed in the middle of America by a non-American. Rupert Murdoch is an Australian, you know, and it's a hypnotic device. And it's going to make you worry about things that you shouldn't be worried about. So turn it off.
It's interesting, Dan. I flip through Fox, and listening is not an endorsement for me. You know, that's my background. It's the research. You know, consumer research. I mean, I want to know what the other side says. It doesn't mean I agree with them. Now, there are certain opinion shows that I refuse to watch. I mean, you couldn't pay me enough to do research on them. There are certain people that just blatantly racist, and I know. So I don't need to do research, but in terms of their editorial page and how biased they are, I listen to them to learn, not to endorse their opinions. And I think that's the element that's missing sometimes with opposing views and that type of understanding. People think listening is endorsing. And it's just like Twitter, Dan. You know, people follow people that they hate. It doesn't mean they're endorsing them, but they follow them. Sure. They want to know what they say. And that's the piece, whether it's marketing or rhetoric, that people do in order to even, before they even try to persuade.
I think that's, you know, that's always a testament to people when they're doing research about things that they don't agree with. You know, it's a good approach to, like I said, discovery. I tell people to be a little careful with Fox because it's a non-cognitive, like the media in general is a non-cognitive persuasion machine, which means it's using things to go underneath your cognitive defenses, sound cues, stings, soundtracks, the way that they deliver stuff emotionally. Like they're constantly, if you look at their facial expressions on Fox, they're constantly, you know, just outraged or dubious or, you know, irritated by the way the left is doing things. And so they can import that emotion, even in people that are just good, smart people doing research, you feel that emotion coming at you. And that's what they catch people with. That's why I said it's a hypnotic device. You know, it's literally a brainwashing device because it goes under your cognition with these techniques. And that's why when people end up not making sense to you, like, how could they believe that? Well, it's because it's literally not a cognitive belief. It's an implanted belief done emotionally and with sort of high production value and all that. So it's a dangerous entity. Like we wouldn't let any other culture do that. If Saudi Arabia opened up a fifth network in this country, you know, and like called it whatever, like they call themselves Fox. That's Fox is a dangerous animal. It's a sneaky animal. They told you right up, hey, we're a fox and we're getting in your hen house and we're going to do different propaganda. We wouldn't let any non-Anglo culture have done that.
I agree.
So
I agree, but I would kind of push the envelope there a little bit. That's how they feel about MSNBC. That's how the opposing side, who are not the fanatics, who are not the racists, feel that way about the other media outlets. And I think just hearing both sides, and I don't hear them as often. I have to listen. I have to be very honest. It's not like I divide up my time 50-50. But I think trying to understand where the other side comes in also keeps me honest about the party that I endorse, because Democrats are not perfect by any means. It's not like Democrats have zero corruption. I mean, politics is politics. And sometimes I feel the centrists on both sides are the flip side of the same coin. And all we're dealing with is the far left versus far right views. That's just my opinion. But, you know, they all have their own special interest group, their, you know, corporate donations, everything that leads into some of the policies that may or may not be necessarily discussed in media. So I think in order to kind of at least keep myself honest, I need to hear the other side sometimes to just go, well, you know, and of course I'm at a point where I can make up my mind, and you know, it takes a lot to persuade me.
Of course it does. You're Arnaz. You don't just get persuaded just like that.
But I see what you're saying too, in terms of the danger for people that haven't researched or haven't studied as much as we all have, and how easily they could be persuaded. But to me, for a liberal to say, I will never listen to that side, is not that different than a Trump supporter just completely saying, I will never listen to that side. So I think we need some, we have some work to do in that area.
Yeah, it's a interesting, like, again, one of my taglines for Rhetoric Warriors is complicated times require sophisticated techniques. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has happened to the left to diminish the power of the left in some ways is this idea of fairness, right? And balance, mm-hmm. and, you know, listening to multiple perspectives. Like, that has become a valorized idea for the left.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people on the left are like, yeah, I can see the value and why we should be like that. But that's actually been implanted by the right. That's actually in rhetoric that would be called like the biggest fallacy that I find amongst arguments in politics is false equivalencies. So it's this idea that the right has literally put that in your mind. Fox was literally founded on the phrase fair and balanced, you know, mm-hmm. because they knew that would resonate with the left and that they would get some of the left to watch. There are other ways of getting, you know, information about the right that aren't Fox, that aren't super produced media. You know, you can go and research the right through the print media forever. There's some great journalists who that's all they cover is the far right and the right itself. And you can read about it in, you know, different publications. Getting it from reading, so much less intense than getting it from TV. And the TV is the dangerous part, you know, and you're strong-minded, you're well-educated, and, you know, you're a thinker and you've, you know, protected your brain in a lot of ways. But even you, like what you just said to me, is literally a script given to you by the right, a much more subtle script that the left has accepted. And I would tell them, like, when I do consulting for anybody on the left, and I'm going to start moving into more of this about consulting with left groups or, you know, Democratic groups, those sort of moderate scripts that have been put into the left are dangerous too. Because saying, like, well, they're both politics and they both take that's a false equivalency. You know, it's a truth, but it's an overstated truth. And so you end up questioning, like, and I hear liberals do this all the time. They'll be talking about the Democrats and they'll denigrate their own party as a way of showing that they're being fair and balanced before they launch into an attack on the right. They'd be like, I'm not saying the Democrats are perfect, which is exactly what you said. Because they know they'll get attacked for that.
Let me Dan push on that a little bit.
Do it.
From a marketing standpoint, I think that whole statement of Fox is fair and balanced was not targeted toward liberals. For the longest time, decades and decades, the right always felt media is very biased. So that whole slogan toward the left, and that whole slogan of fair and balanced was to target them. And I have to say, purely from a marketing standpoint, it worked beautifully. It worked beautifully because they monopolized the right media because of that. So just purely from a marketing standpoint and not necessarily rhetoric or persuasion, that tagline worked for them to attract all of the Republicans to watch. Then after that, it started kind of, you know, they started having fringes, but Fox just dominated it because they called it that.
Yeah. And there are multiple effects of all those things. And I think you're exactly right. You know, it did help them gather, you know, a huge right group.
It was a good marketing strategy is what I'm trying to say. Just purely from a marketing standpoint, it was a good marketing strategy to monopolize the right-wing media. And they're still monopolizing it. In terms of what you were saying, that's what Fox wanted me, or kind of not me, but a metaphoric me, wanted me to believe that. the reason I want to push on that is because, you know, I am unapologetically a Bernie supporter. And what the left media did with Bernie, I called it a media coup. Last minute, I mean, it felt like a media coup. And the way they characterized Bernie on liberal media was exactly like Fox. There was no difference. All these things that you're talking about with Fox, I heard MSNBC, CNN, and all of the media do it. And they literally brainwashed a lot of people that agreed with Bernie's policies to scare them, and it worked to scare them. Now, I can shoot holes in Bernie's campaign too, from a marketing standpoint and the mistakes that they made, but purely from a policy standpoint, majority of Democrats agreed with his policies. They thought he wasn't electable. And guess who did that? The liberal media, not Fox. Yeah.
Well, I would say the conservative media did that, like conservative right and left. And you made this point earlier, the centrists right around there are typically about, you know, stability and non-change. So anything too far to the right, anything too far to the left, they can't handle. So they're going to do that. They're going to, you know, misrepresent it. They're going to make it seem more dangerous than it probably is. Not going to give it as much time, all that kind of stuff. They tell a, you know, a very centrist story about the world, you know, and it's, I think that's absolutely correct, you know, but it's the problem sometimes becomes with the way people talk about the media is that they talk about it like it's a conscious decision by the media to do this to Bernie. And it's really more about the aesthetics of the center of America, that's what works for their TV viewership. And so they'd have to also almost make a, you know, decision to not do that to Bernie, to get a more sophisticated type of story to tell about Bernie, you know, and that's not what the mainstream media does. There's plenty of fringe media that does it very well. Again, like the New Yorker, you know, some of the cities that have always had very, you know, well-funded alternative medias and strong, you know, family-owned medias tell those stories very well. But the centrist media, the networks and stuff like that, and even the cable networks, they can't tell those stories. There's no shade. There's no nuance to their story. So it does become this sort of just center. Everything outside the center is too weird. We don't know how to handle it. So it gets marginalized. But I don't think it's conscious. Everybody's looking at it like it's a conspiracy by the media. And I'm like, you know, if you actually understand the way messaging works, like it's a dominant narrative and the media can't move outside of it. But that's not because like they're all getting together in a meeting and going, you know, this guy Bernie, he's a little too far. So if you want to tell those stories better, and Bernie, like I said, I think you're right, they could have told their story in a way that matched up more with the mainstream media, you know, with the centrist media, and been more successful. But Bernie comes off a lot of times because he's so angry. He's so vehement on camera, which works really well for the young and the millennials, but it scares, you know, the people in the middle who aren't used to being yelled at by their politicians.
I think that aspect is true. And I don't disagree with that, but I think you put way too much more weight on that than I do. I, having been so close to media from a business standpoint, not from a messaging standpoint, purely from a business standpoint. It's a business and it needs to run by ads and corporate and so forth. And sure, what you're saying is true, because if they tell a story people don't want to hear, people don't buy ads. I get that. But at the same time, what Bernie was suggesting with a lot of the policies threaten a lot of corporations, corporations than you and I think. And if you don't think those corporations put pressure on the media to tell a story they want to tell, then, you know, we need to go back to square one, because I believe they do. So, sure. You know, sure, part of it is the marketing and what people want to hear, but Trump came in and did exactly the opposite. It's almost a chicken and egg thing, Dan. What I'm trying to say is Trump didn't necessarily say what people wanted to say. Trump said what needed to be said for the people that were not getting that message. Maybe Bernie could have done the same, but I don't think corporations would have allowed that the big corporations, which are the flip side of the same thing with the government, in my opinion. Government and big corporations are the flip side of the same coin. They feed off of each other. They have to. One will not exist without the other. So when you get those big pharma and big insurance companies that basically have so much power over media threatened, they're not going to tell you this story to test to see if people want to hear it. We don't know if people didn't want to hear it. It was so much negativity toward it. So it's a chicken and egg thing. Maybe you're right. Maybe people wanted a different story, so media supported that. But I say people didn't get the true story to show whether or not they want to support it. The yeah. same thing I was telling you about the coverage about Islamic countries. The same thing about, you know, I give you an example. Americans in general don't see Saudi Arabia as a terrorist country. They see Iran as a terrorist country. Now I can show you a ton of research that says all the terrorists are coming from Saudi Arabia. But the media is not telling that story for a reason. And all of that has to do with money and sponsorships and corporations and oil or whatever it may be. So Iran, that hasn't necessarily attacked any of the American buildings or anything like that, is viewed as a terrorist country, whereas it's actually the Saudi Arabia. Or let's take, is it okay if I go to the fringes of this discussion?
Oh, sure. Yeah, go wherever. I'm all ears.
Yeah, it's kind of like the fear that they have created by, oh my God, the nuclear agreement with Iran. If you look at just the map, every country around Iran has nuclear weapons. Every country. Well, Pakistan, India, not everyone, but Saudi, Israel, I mean, they're all around Iran, I mean, geographically. So when Americans think, oh my God, it's so dangerous for Iran to have one, they don't get the flip side of how many atomic bombs exist in more dangerous companies like Pakistan. I think Obama was the first one who mentioned it. It's not mentioned because they need the narrative around Iran for a reason. So I think it doesn't pass the purity test with me as much as it does with you.
Well, and I'm not saying I think you're completely right. So again, this idea of trying to get some sophistication, you know, in complicated times. So the corporate explanation, you know, and you've got deep experience in that business and you've seen it, and you know, that's real. That's a strong way, you know, of explaining the messaging that gets through in America. And I would never argue that. It's completely, you know, a viable principle that, hey, like Trump came in. And so there's Trump and Bernie were the same character in a lot of ways. They're both anti-heroes. You know, they're both attacking the mainstream culture in different ways. Bernie's problem, like you said, is he's attacking, you know, into a capitalist country. He's attacking capitalism. Tough sell. You know, you're going to get blowback. You're going to get organized defenses from corporations and all that kind of stuff. And they, like you said, they heavily influence media. Trump at least was capitalist friendly. They knew, you know, that he was going to, whatever he did, I don't think they knew he would destabilize everything as much as he did, but they knew at least the guy's a business guy. We can, you know, trust that he's going to do some good things for corporations. So they were both anti-heroes, though, both about let's blow up the system in some way because I don't like it. We can make it better. We can do whatever. And so, yeah, in complicated times, definitely corporate as an explanation. Definitely also story aesthetics, you know, the limits of story mediums and things like that as a explanation. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of that kind of overlap. And that's what I'm, you know, interested in. That's why I talk to so many different people on the podcast. Is it's always expanding, you know, the pie of things. Like in one of the free webinars I do about the discovery part with MAGA and, you know, Trump voters, is that's a complicated demographic pie. You know, we're seeing all the, you know, fringe militia types, you know, on the hill, like the Capitol storming, but that's one slice of pie within the MAGA movement. They didn't have 74 million people show up there. You know, they had maybe a few thousand. And that's to really understand that movement, you can't just pick that one slice and say, that's the explanation. You have to have a sophisticated overview of what's happening.
And I was just purely from a business and marketing standpoint, I was fascinated because it wasn't Trump being a great brand builder or marketer. It actually started with, and the sophistication.
It started with who? You're cutting out on me just a little bit.
Okay, it started with Brexit, actually.
Right.
With Mercer and a lot of this big data analysis, I was really fascinated by the methodology, not necessarily the messaging. So I did study that. And to be able to kind of go in and identify thousands and thousands in England, I think it was only 3,000, but here in the excess of 250,000-500,000 people that have not gotten out there to vote, and what their pain points were, and hit that with Trump's message, I would venture to say that if Bernie's campaign was that smart and could identify, because they had the same pinpoints.
Right.
The government's not working for me. I'm not represented. And if his campaign was that smart, instead of scaring the hell out of people and say, revolution, revolution, you know, after 4 years of revolution, you know, nobody wants it. Messaging was wrong, but the sophistication of the marketing and how to target those people, you know, all Democrats needed to do was to convince those people of the lie, and they didn't do it.
Yeah.
They didn't do it. They didn't know how. They either did now, or they were too centrist. I think it's a combination of both. They didn't want Bernie to win. It would have been that easy to convince Trump's lies with that overlap of their voters.
Yeah, and I think it would have been it's a really super valuable perspective that you've got. To, you know, you keep bringing it back to marketing and business. You know, the thing about Trump is that was all of his connections were business people. So you had like, you know, Bannon and these guys who had created, you know, marketing machines that typically are used to gather capitalist information to sell things. Very easy to just move that over into selling Trump or selling Brexit. And that's that super sophistication and discovery, which then tells you exactly what your messaging should be. As opposed to, like I said, the left is not nearly as organized in its messaging machine. The right is incredibly organized and sophisticated in all the steps down that pipeline to make sure they get the right message to the right person, the right amount of times, at the right, you know, juncture. And so the left will start to adopt these as well, you know, because anything that becomes an advance, the other side sees it and adopts it. Obama did a lot more of that. And I think Biden, you know, one of the values of Biden is that either it's because he's so old and he doesn't really, you know, want to do the hardcore control every day. He's brought in a lot of people who are open to all this stuff that's been developed, to using it, as opposed to, like, you know, a lot of older politicians who are still like, I'm going to go with my gut here. It's like, yeah, he's got some of that for sure. Like this whole thing he's doing now about unity and like reaching out to the other side. That's old school American politics that he learned in the Senate, that people will actually agree with you and, you know, find a compromise. That's not the way politics runs right now. And so I'm a little worried that, you know, if he holds on to that too hard, it's going to just be exploited by the right. But he's got a lot of people around him who come from that kind of background you're talking about, a hardcore business experience, and they will use that same data pointing to adjust the messages, make them more targeted. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next cycle.
I hope you're right. Right. And but I still think the role that media plays to support the center, whether it's the right or the left, is really, really big. And the only reason Trump won was because the center supported him because of his policies. And Bernie didn't have that support. Otherwise, the messaging were not that different. But that's the power of media that we're talking about. And that's why I question sometimes Well, I don't question, I kind of am aware of both sides brainwashing, because I've seen it happen to the party that I supported on the liberal side as well, not just the Trump supporter.
Yeah, let me explain the difference in the way I see it and why the term brainwashing, like I'm trying to expand some of our persuasion vocabulary, because it's a lot of its legacy vocabulary. Like the word brainwashing, you know, comes from the Chinese, you know, from the 70s and Mao and all the re-education camps and all that. And it's a very specific set of techniques. And it's informative, but it's not really what's happening right now with the media. The media does what I would call some type of, you know, media mesmerization or hypnotism on people. And it uses a lot of the same techniques like hyper-repetition, hyper-emotionality, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the left doesn't do that. The left does not have a script machine that tells everybody, and you've seen it over the last week, start using the word unity over and over and over. And the right immediately, the think tanks after that insurrection, the think tanks were like, here's the three responses, send it out. And they all start saying the same thing. And that's the kind of brainwashing, you know, where it's a mono message repeated over and over again with no variation that creates brainwashing. The left doesn't have that. They're still splintered in their response. They will definitely be anti-Bernie, you know, because it's too far away from their center, but they won't all say exactly the same thing about Bernie. It's not given out as a centrist script. It's more given out as a policy against, like you're saying, against radicalism.
Dan, you don't think so?
There's no left think tank handing out script words to the media.
You don't think that was used against Bernie with Medicare for all and free college tuition? I think those were very scripted, the words that they used. They kept saying, how do we pay for it? How do we pay for it? How do we pay for it?
That's just them picking up the right's response, yeah. But centrist media will do that.
But the same technique.
The difference. The difference is that it's like the right almost has like a central communist government in its infrastructure for its communication. It literally has a pipeline of think tanks. That's what they do. They hand it down to the media. They hand it to the politicians. The left doesn't do the same thing. Like CNN is not getting its script from, you know, the Brookings Institute. It may, you know, pick up script points from places, but it doesn't have that sort of structured pipeline. And to do brainwashing,
not even to protect the center.
No, it's just natural to the messaging of the center that we've always talked this way. This is basically how we talk, and we're going to keep talking this way. If somebody comes in from the left, that's too far away from the center, we're going to have a hard time adjusting to that. But it's not this organized attack on alternative, you know, perspectives that the right does. It's one of the reasons why the right is so effective over the last, you know, ever since the mid 80s with Gingrich, is that they've been developing this machine that attacks anything that goes outside their, you know, policies that they want. And it's incredibly effective.
I think you're right.
Sorry, I lost you. You may be gone.
Question of how do we pay? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. This whole notion of how do we pay for it never comes up with ambitious policies like Space Force or the larger military. It never comes up. Anything that the right does that requires a lot of money, Democrats never ask, how do we pay for it? Democrats don't even show the difference between Democrat and Republican leadership and how that correlates to deficit. Republican Party is viewed as this financially, fiscally responsible party, and yet under their leadership is when we see the deficits go up.
Yeah, because they use, in my world, that's austerity rhetoric.
Right.
And then they use it as cover for spending.
Right.
You know, and for cutting taxes, which is a form of spending.
Right.
But austerity rhetoric. So Bernie uses austerity rhetoric, you know, about, he doesn't use austerity. He uses sharing rhetoric. You know, let's use these. he uses the rhetoric of economics of let's use this money better. You know, this whole thing about, hey, if we invest in childcare, we get all this money back. If we invest in Medicare for All, it actually saves us money. That's all that sort of reasonable or rational uses of money. And I think that was the big appeal of Bernie. You know, he's like, quit listening to all this austerity rhetoric from the other side because it's not true. And he was pretty good at explaining why it wasn't true. Are you there? I think I lost you. Yeah, we got knocked off there a little bit. So what I was saying was that when you, the value of rhetoric is that it gives you a language for sort of dissecting how these rhetoric conflicts come together. So a lot of Bernie's talk is about money and about the proper use of money. And the right, they have a very simple, you know, talk about money. It's way oversimplified and it's completely unethical because it's untrue. But it's, you know, austerity rhetoric, and they're going to do it to Biden. You know, it's exactly what you said. How are we going to pay for it? Well, that resonates with America because we understand not having enough money, and we don't like taxes because they've been basically, you know, slandering taxes for 30 and 40 years. Reagan came in and just slandered taxes, like, ah, it's all wasted. So, oh, well, oh, great, great. We can have a government with no money. Is that your point? You know, versus Bernie, it's like, hey, we're going to take it taxes. Let's spend it correctly and have a good culture. What do you think? Which is a great message, but.
I particularly liked some words he used, like corporate welfare versus social welfare. You know, they did some things right, but purely in terms of just persuasion and just the overall marketing aspect of it, I agree with you. The right does a much, much better job. And in persuading the people of their message. Remember how they called Obama the exact same thing they called Bernie. Remember that 8 years ago? Socialist, he's gonna, you know, he's gonna turn this country into a third world country. And Obama was a centrist. Nobody on the left turned around and said, it doesn't matter what Bernie says versus Biden, they're gonna call all of us socialists. And that's the strategy that they use regardless of who's running on the left. But the point I'm making was the left didn't want to support Bernie and media didn't want to support Bernie for their own special interest and corporations and money. And that's why he lost. Otherwise the messaging was correct. But that's where the establishment comes in. It's almost like this huge center, which I don't know, what do you think, about 80%? So you got 10% here, 10% there, and the rest are all just in the middle and they all support corporations. Would you say?
I mean, it's a capitalist culture. So persuading into a capitalist culture is tricky. And I think Bernie made some really good inroads, you know, some good headway with it. I think it needs to be like, I would adjust the messaging that I do this sort of validation before criticism, you know, kind of model. So I think he needed to do a little more outreach of saying, look, corporations are great. They're a good thing for America. We are a corporate dominated America. He goes, but no capitalism works well without some limits. It ends up just, and it's an absolute viable position that unrestrained capitalism just kills cultures, you know, because it's just about draining money. That's its nature. It's not about doing social good. So if you want a viable capitalism, a healthy capitalism needs limits. And so these are all the ways of, like, if you look at, you know, Bernie, like maybe you could make his message still strong, still to get the things that he wants, but more appealing to centrist. But the big point sort of in rhetoric is, every time you say something, that's why it's a rhetoric war, the other side is going to try to slander you and what you've said. And the right is very good at slandering, especially on money. And, you know, the whole socialist, communist, all that kind of stuff, people don't even know what those words mean. It doesn't matter. The right is just slandering. And the left has to have techniques and strategies for dealing with that. And they're not doing it very well right now because they end up backpedaling and responding to it and letting it dominate. I would just, you know, attack them back. I, you know, don't ever respond to a slander, because it just repeats the slander. I made this point with Hillary Clinton, that if she'd just gone after Trump with some really good one-liners, some zingers, she'd probably been, fine. Like, instead of letting him attack her, like, just attack him. She just wasn't very good at it. The left isn't nearly as good with its slander.
Well, the left always wants to pass the purity test with language. They definitely don't pass the purity test with policies, but they definitely, they always think, let's not get in the mud with the pigs. Well, guess what? Nancy Pelosi got in the mud with Trump.
Yeah, she's good at it.
She's good at it.
She's a good lefty. She'll slice.
She is good at it. And it's like, okay, I'm gonna impeach, and I'm not gonna ask anyone whether or not I should. That's the kind of stuff that I think the left needs to get better at. I think the left is too apologetic, in terms of just the persuasion versus like you're saying, pick a few points and repeat it. And that's exactly what that company, I forgot the name of the company that Mercer was heading, not Cambridge, but it was another company that did the Brexit. They exactly copied the Brexit strategy here. They identified the people, that population, they identified by zip code where they live, and they pounded the same message over and over and over again. And it was all about, don't trust media, don't trust this, take the country back. Because what does that mean? They take the country away from you.
Yeah.
I have Iranians telling me this country is going downhill. I said, give me one example of how it's going downhill. Give me one example of how this country went downhill in 8 years of Obama. But then people believed it.
Yeah.
People believed because they kept hearing it over and over again. And left just doesn't do that.
Well, in marketing that your commercials can't say everything. You make them say one or two things, and then you buy as many of them as you can.
Yep.
Right. And you just repeat them in as many variations without ever changing the message, because that's a really strong way to persuade through the media, And if you're going to use the media, that's how you have to do it, because there's so many messages coming at you. You know that you need, it's like Geico, to pick a couple of things, get a lizard on there, two slogans, and just say it for 40 years over and over again. And maybe you'll get some market penetration after you spend a lot of money.
What you're saying fits along with what we are discussing in terms of persuading the right. In any strategy, whether it's political, persuasion, marketing, they're all the same. There is benefits and trade-offs, right? Without the trade-offs, you can't get the benefit. The left doesn't want to have trade-off. That's the problem. What I always say is, there is no middle with the bigot. So you have to use them as a trade-off. Okay, we can't convince them. You have to use trade-offs because, you look at businesses like, let's say, Southwest Airlines, that's been studied by so many marketers. They traded off seat assignments and meals on flight so they can be cheapest and fastest, right? Do you know how many complaints they got that they wanted seat assignments and they wanted meals? They ignored it. Whereas a lot of marketers get into this trap of, satisfy all customers. You can't be all to everyone. And I think what the left is trying to do is exactly that. Whereas, there are some trade-offs. There are some certain people that are not going to, and you mentioned that in one of your newsletters, you got to know when certain people, you're not going to try to persuade them. You're not going to try to, please them, because they won't, no matter what you say. No matter what you say to a hardcore Trump supporter or a hardcore gun right person, it doesn't matter what you say. They will never be persuaded.
Yeah, I the way I explain it a lot of times, you're talking about I have a sort of a four chord or four notch system for people who are yes, yes, who just agree with you with no, no in there. And then there's yes, no's, no yeses and no, no's. And it's not worth going after the no-nos. You can change anyone. It's just the effort it takes is going to take all your resources, and you're going to lose the yes no's, which is where you should do most of your persuasion. And then the no yeses, you know, maybe 75% no, but there's a amount of yes in there. So it's worth it if you have extra resources. But going after the no no's, man, you're just banging your head. That's why the course that I'm doing is Convert One Conservative. Everybody's trying to do, you know, argument online and with all the, I'm like, no, pick one person in your life that you think has dangerous or politics that you don't like from the right, and I'll show you how to talk to them, because that's all the energy you've got, you know, to get change from the no-nos. Get ready, because you're going to be doing some work, and it may be worth it to you if it's your mom or if it's your uncle or if it's your kid or whatever, because in families, you see that a lot. You lose people to political perspectives. And, you know, that's a pain point for a lot of people in their families. So,
I mean, we're both single. Would you ever date a no-no that completely disagrees? I mean, you can't. It's the same thing with the persuasion and marketing. You know, you just can't find that commonality. And with those that you can find commonalities, those are the trade-offs you have to make.
Yeah. And it's so unpleasant to do. I tell people all the time, like, persuasion is not a fun activity. Like, it's unpleasant to talk to people who disagree with you, and that you've got to go in there and stay with it anyway. It's work. And so, again, like, you know, this in marketing, figuring out what to say, the amount of research that you've got to do, you know, and then the work you have to do to make a great message, you know, all that stuff takes incredible resources and talent and, you know, money and time. And so, yeah, persuasion is not for the faint of heart, but if it's important to you, you know, to actually get change in people, then this is what you sign up for. And again, yeah, that's the whole purpose of the course, is to get you more sophisticated, so you're more effective faster, you know. So maybe
so how do you identify the no-nos? How do you identify those trade? How do you identify the no-nos, and how do you identify the trade-offs?
Yeah, well, like you said, you got to go in and research it. And there's usually the no-nos will let you know pretty vehemently. You know, especially in politics, like, it's crazy how quickly they want to, you know, express how different they believe than you do, you know. And the left is the same way. Like, my daughter, you know, is a millennial and strong social issues, and she will let me know right away if I say a wrong word or a wrong, you know, opinion. And for me to persuade her, which I do sometimes, because I think people that are just triggerable, that's a problem in the world. It doesn't matter if you're left or right. The left and the right are both highly triggerable. And that means you're not in control of your own emotions. And that's a problem. So with my daughter, I'm like, let me help you try to get back into control of your emotions and understand your perspective, so that you're not just running script and you're not being reactive. And the left has that problem. You know, you say one wrong word and they just blow up like it's somehow a landmine. And I'm like, take your time and, you know, decide what you're trying to get. If you want to teach me something that I've made a mistake on, awesome. But if you're going to come at me with indictments, you know, and that I'm now this evil villain because of missaying a certain word or a term, then you're going to have a hard time with me, you know?
Yeah.
So, well, it's been great. Hey, I don't want to take up too much of your time. You
know, no problem.
I always like talking to you, and you get great perspectives. So I really appreciate it. Anything you want to promote? Are you still trying to do the Farnaz Global? Or
I'm not selling anything. I just wanted to have some fun and talk to you.
Well, if anybody does hear this and is like, Farnaz, man, I'd like to bring her in to talk. She gives great talks, great presentations. So maybe call her up and offer a lot of money to go do that. And
that would be a great idea.
Yeah. It's always very persuasive. Loads of money for doing something that you like. a good offer. Well, thanks, Farnaz. Appreciate very much. And we will continue to talk. And I will see everybody else on the next episode of Rhetoric Warriors.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Oops.